Okay, and we're back, and hour number three brings us to our third visit with one of the most interesting gentlemen we've had on the program in a long time. He is Nigel Kerner, and he is in the UK. We're going to talk to Nigel, and we're also going to talk to Dr. Andrew Silverman, an associate of his, about some very interesting things. Now, they have published a paper called The Brightest Light of All, and the abstract is short but gets to the point here. There is a substantial body of evidence supporting the hypothesis that the Turin Shroud, or the Shroud of Turin, surface image was caused by a very brief burst of radiant energy. Our subject for discussion in this paper is about how a dead body could produce the radiation. How did a corpse shine momentarily brighter than the sun? We postulate a dynamic interface between thought, light, and matter, which implies that the mind-matter duality resolves on the side of mind as the prime mover, that our physicality is a symptom of restriction of mind, which, when free, transforms matter into light. Very interesting paper. Nigel, are you there?
Hello there, Jeff. Greetings to you from England.
Greetings to you. Welcome back.
Yeah. Well, the dawn is breaking. I hope we have something interesting to say to your listeners.
Well, you always have. This is going to be very good. And Dr. Silverman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Andrew here. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Thanks for getting up early. How long have you two been collaborating?
Many years.
Well, you want to take that one, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I first met Nigel's family actually when I was just a kid, just 12 years old. So that was just over 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by this. He had a full length print of the picture of the Turin Shroud on the wall in his living room, which really fascinated me.
Wow.
And that's how I first got interested in the Turin Shroud.
Well, that would fascinate me, too. That's quite a thing to have on your living room wall. All right. Now, what we're doing here is again, having a third conversation with Nigel Kerner. And his website is nigelkerner.com. And I hope you'll visit it and take a look, because it is utterly unique in the field. I guess we could call it ufology, but it's much more than that. It's how would you term it? What words would you use, Nigel, to describe the area of your expertise and your research?
Well, I think after doing the research into it, quite surprisingly, I think it's the final interest we all should have existentially in anything, really, basically, because this business of UFOs, I thought, was simply lights dancing in the sky and all that Buck Rogers stuff. Came at it as an absolute skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
Ready to dismiss it, did the research, and of course discovered that it's probably the most important secret kept by man ever. And the interesting thing, as I said before, Jeff, is the connections. As you make these connections and connect up the dots, so to speak, it reveals something so enormous and so significant to our human condition that it was no way that I could ignore it in those terms. And incidentally, just want to give you a little bit of a human relations thing with Andrew. He walked into my house as a 12-year-old boy quoting Descartes. Now, that
oh,
was
really?
So surprising.
That's funny. Well, don't all 12-year-old boys do that? What do you mean?
Well, I'll tell you what, I hadn't met any up to then that even quoted the ABC correctly.
Correct.
Never mind Descartes.
Yeah, yeah. Very good.
Friendships endured all these years based upon Descartes.
Well, good. Now, the new book that Nigel has produced has an unusual title. It's much more than the title. Let me just leave it at that. It's called Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. All right? The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. Now, maybe that would have been a better primary title. Just flip them around.
Well,
but anyway, this is a very interesting subject. We've explored it twice now. This is the third time. And we have Dr. Silverman with us tonight. So, Nigel, I'm going to let you go ahead, and we're going to talk about the shroud itself and the ET phenomenon and let you lay it out. And we'll ask you, if you would, to bring Andrew in as you would like, because I really don't know where to pull this. So I'm going to be a listener as well, to a large degree. So yeah. go right ahead.
The whole point about this shroud was that it actually reveals to us the intentions and the demarcations that are to be found with the UFO phenomenon and our existential outlay as a species, as mm-hmm. a living being there type of species, Jeff. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest surprise I got, because it related to something which I had no real interest in, which was religion in any sense. I'm kind of soaked in science, as I said before.
Right.
And I really did get the biggest surprise of my life when I was looking at the whole question, and it was leading back all the time to talking about the verifications of these great philosophical thoughts given to us by the great teachers at the beginning of things and so on. And when I saw that this was leading there, I kind of recoiled a bit to start with, but I let it go, because obviously it was really obviously leading in this direction. And then I've discovered mm-hmm. that when I finally made this correlation between what I call a soul, which is simply a line of connection from a beginning beyond the universe that each one of us has, simply an information line that marks you and I in our individuality from the beginning point, right, a natural line, and that's the most important thing I'd like to accent there, is the natural line. It is not an artificially engendered thing. It's a natural cascade, you, mom, dad, great-granddad, great-grand, so on, all the way back to a point. Now, each one of us has this incredible ancestral epithet, so to speak. That's the important thing. And then you ally that against something that happens now with intelligence and technology and all the rest of it. We make artificial things happen. We create things that are synthetic. Now, these things are being given artificial intelligence and all that kind of thing. And if then that is given its own addendum, so to speak, entire scope to be what it might be potentially, we have a big deal in the entire universe of a battle between what is natural against mm-hmm. what is artificial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the correlation here is that the great teachers were pointing out within their scope and their wisdom and perception and so on, that this is the mighty line we have to guard. We must never be dominated or in any kind of way compromised by anything synthetic that might be technologically made superior, so to speak, than our naturalness. So our humanity, our sense of conscience, our sense of mercy, our sense of compassion, and all those things are really spokesmen to the power of our natural sense of eternal being. The fact we come from this ancestry right down to the present time suggests we have an eternal scope. But anything mm-hmm. that's synthetic has a verifiably temporal scope. And the problem is it's more powerful in as much if it's dealing with the here and the now and the things that go on, if you like, in our everydayness and so forth. But what the great teachers are saying is, do not get beguiled by all of this. Guard your consistency in terms of an eternal scope, and then you will survive beyond life and death and return and all that kind of thing. And of course, the book is related to making this argument in as substantially verified a way as I possibly could. No claims. Here it is. It's based on science. It's the empirical business turned, if you like, into a religious scope. And mm-hmm. that's really, that there are numerous accounts, for instance, within the many Coptic texts on the open Bible. Jesus explains to his apostles, you know, how you deal with alien beings. Actually, it's there. If you look at the old texts, you find that this is actually there, this incredible assertion. And of course, when I come late to this beautiful Jew that lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago, and how this guy may well have encountered this UFO phenomenon, as explaining an incredible occurrence which happened to him when he was taken to a high place. I don't know what kind of Christian background you might have, or the listener. I'm sure the listeners would understand that as part of the Bible dissertation. And Andrew has something very interesting to say on this. And that made the connection for me between this individual, Jesus Christ, and then later on, as a result of that, in fact, as a consequence of that, the relationship with the Turin Shroud emerged, and its propensity to point in our direction at the massive, the mighty scope that we all have. in terms of what this man was pointing out, and his life was pointing out, and in fact his entry and exit from our own domain, dominion, if you like, on this planet was pointing out so tragically in his death and so forth. And let me say this. It points against tribes, Jeff. It really does point against tribalism, whether it's the nuclear family or an extended family or whatever, the things that make so wrong what's happening in the world today in many ways, that we get into these little cartels and so on. What he was trying to say is that there is a condition called natural humanity that will take you into a forever scope, so to speak.
Very
and
good.
That's the most important thing to God, that forever scope, in inverted commas, so to speak. So I'll pass you on to Andrew, because I think in discussing the Shroud, he has a wonderful psychological take on this.
Very good.
And remember, Andrew is Jewish.
Okay.
I have a Christian back.
All right. Stand by, and we'll be back in just a minute with Dr. Andrew Silberman. Okay, let's get right back to Nigel Kerner and Dr. Andrew Silberman. Okay, Andrew, please go right ahead if you would. We're all ears.
Thank you. Yeah, Nigel was alluding to a particular story earlier that's written in the New Testament, where it said that Jesus was taken to a high point and was a place where he could see all the cities of the earth, and of course, and was then this is known, I think, in Christian circles as the temptation, and he was offered that all those cities that he could see would all be given to him if he would just bow down and so on. Now, one of the interesting things there is that he was taken to a point that was so high that he could see all the cities of the earth. Now, the listeners might want to do a little experiment here with if they have a spherical globe, that if you actually orientate it in a certain position and step far enough away from it, you can see pretty much all the landmass of the world all from one point, but you have to be beyond the atmosphere. You have to be in space to be able to see all the cities of the earth.
Well, sure.
Which is an interesting point. And also, of course, he referred to this thing that took him up to the high point as Satan, which is a mythological character who is supposed to have fallen from the sky, which is also interesting. And it does sort of, it's quite consistent, really, with Nigel's thesis that there is the thing which is the word Satan literally means adversary, the thing that is the in opposition to the natural humanity is actually something from beyond this planet, and something that is actually not even living. Because, of course, if it was as far away as you can possibly get from God, and it was, you know, commonly believed that human beings have life, have sentience, a connection to God, then whatever it is that's going to be as far away from God as you can imagine, or the Godhead principle, if you like, is probably not going to have that living ability. It's not going to have a mind or free will. It's going to be an object, like a robot. So I just thought I'd mention that first. But what I'd really like to talk about is the Turin Shroud, of course. Now, I should just say a little introduction to what that is for any listeners who aren't familiar with it. It's a 14-foot-long piece of cloth, which is kept in Turin, Italy, and it actually has some very interesting images on it. It has, apart from some of the marks are from fire damage that happened in the 16th century, there's also red marks on it that look like bloodstains, which have later, more recently, been found to actually be human bloodstains.
Yes.
And then there's also the image on the shroud. Now, for many centuries, this image was thought to be very faint and indistinct, but basically in the shape of a man. But of course, with the advent of photography at the end of the 19th century, when it was first photographed by Secundo Pia, the story goes that he nearly dropped his photographic plate in shock when he saw the photographic negative, because the negative image of the shroud is actually a perfect photographic positive. And you know, so for those people who think that it was a medieval forgery, it would have to be quite something to actually design it to be a perfect...
No chance.
Absolutely. Now, in mentioning that, I just want to address the issue of the carbon dating, because, of course, it has to be mentioned. And there'll probably be many listeners who, as soon as they hear the trial, think, oh, yeah, well, of course, that was proved to be medieval by the carbon dating. But not quite. Interestingly, one of the three laboratories that did the carbon dating, the Oxford one in England, one of the key people from there said that he thinks further work needs to be done because there's so much evidence pointing to it being so much older than that, historical evidence and various other forms of evidence, that that perhaps then further tests need to be done. And interestingly, a few years back, a couple of researchers in the States called Benford and Marino noticed that it looked like the bit that was dated was actually a composite, a reweave of a patch that was later sewn in by the nuns. And to cut a long story short, after a lot of doubting of that by the original shroud team, when they actually tested it out, they found that actually when they tried to prove him wrong, they found out that they were proving him right, that it does look like it was a reweave. So that could account for the sort of erroneous dating of it as having seemed younger than it is. But to get back to the image, it's a surface phenomenon on only the surface fibers of the cloth. You can actually, it's so superficial that you could actually scrape it off with a razor blade. Just one brush of a razor blade would take off the image. It's less than the thickness of a human hair.
That's
it's
incredible. Not paint. Wow.
I know. Wow. It's not paint or pigment. The image consists of a chemical change in the structure. It's almost like it's pixelated. A change in the structure of the fibrils, which are the surface layers of the surface fibers of the cloth. And the only way that we've been able to account for anything similar to that is if you use ultraviolet lasers. And one of the researchers at the talk that we went to, and I get the conference we went to where I gave a talk, Dr. Di Lazzaro, has actually done some work on this and found that when you shine ultraviolet laser at very high intensity, for less than a millionth of a second, you actually produce a similar change. But the thing is that the shroud image has what's called distance-coded information, which is unique amongst any photograph.
Mm-hmm.
If you put an ordinary photograph through a machine that looks for distance-coded information, you just get a random set of peaks and troughs. Put the shroud in the same machine, and it comes out in perfect three-dimensional relief, implies that the light that formed the image was actually coming from the body of the man that the shroud wrapped.
I understand. That's just amazing. Hold on. Back in just a minute as we continue. Take a little break and return after this. Okay, and we are back. Talking with Nigel Kerner and Dr. Silverman. That was an excellent description of something that just shouldn't be, but is, Andrew. Anything you want to add to that? Then we'll go back to Nigel.
Yes, please. Yeah. Then you see, talking about the image, it's been studied a lot by forensic pathologists and so on. It seems that it fits perfectly anatomically and physiologically with a sort of someone who had died, that this was a corpse that the shroud wrapped. The blood stains have been actually shown that they were post-mortem blood stains. The blood that was there after he had died, and that the image was formed after the blood marks had got onto the cloth. And in studying the pattern of the blood marks and so on, it seems that this man had been really cruelly tortured. He'd been whipped. There were over 100 breaks in his skin.
Oh my!
And the shapes of the marks fit exactly with what historians, archaeologists have as that they've recovered things called Roman flagrum, which was the kind of whip that the Romans used around the first century.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been pierced in the side, and he'd had this sharp object placed on his head, like a cap of thorns, and you can see the blood trickling down from that. And interestingly, he'd been pierced through the wrist, not through the hand. And we know anatomically it would have had to have been the wrist and not the hand, although all the medieval painters thought it was the hand.
Yes.
Of course, the shroud isn't a painting, of course. But and if you put a nail through the hand, you'll put some changes will happen to something called the median nerve, which is a medical doctor. I'm aware of this, but also, you know, many of the researchers have mm-hmm. also been aware of this,
mm-hmm.
and that will make the thumb tend to move in towards the palm. And in fact, if you look at the image, you can see that you can't see the thumbs because they're behind the hands because of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of the question that was on my mind was who is this person that the shroud image wrapped? Now, I should say I come from a Jewish background, so I don't have any particular axe to grind to say that this was Jesus, or to say that it you know shows him to be genuine or the shroud to be genuine and so on.
I understand.
But this is what the evidence suggests.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, the talk that I gave in Italy at this symposium was about why did this happen? How did this happen? How did a human corpse shine momentarily brighter than the sun? And I sort of got to a way of thinking about it through bearing in mind something that actually Nigel suggested to me decades ago, but even before his book came out, that this idea that we have of mind and matter being, you know, two separate things, that it's actually a continuum, that just as quantum theory suggests, mind and matter are part of one continuum, such that matter is actually comes out of mind rather than the other way around, that it's like frozen thought. And this would explain all the, you know, the of the connections between consciousness, observation, and the atom that the quantum theorists have found. And that actually, looking at some of the early quantum theory writers, such as Schrödinger, for example, they made a connection that said that the fact that mind makes matter real suggests that actually mind is something that isn't made by a body, because the body, matter can't make the mind if the mind makes matter, and also has to be something eternal, because if we're making time happen, then time didn't make us, time can't end us. And to cut a long story short, what it implies is that the singularity at the beginning of the universe actually would have contained all of us as sentient beings, but all as one. And then a separation happened that made universes happen. And to me, it makes more sense to think that happened out of will, out of our choice to be separate, rather than you know, an old man with white beard in the sky pointing his finger.
Yeah, sure, so I understand.
And that actually, if you look at the Big Bang, it's actually, at the beginning there was nothingness, and then there was light, and then there was matter. If you look at the shroud, it's like that in reverse. Matter is becoming light. And, you know, if in trying to understand why this happened, I thought, well, you know, is it just coincidence that this unique event in human history, as far as we know, is associated with the individual who has made, you know, one of the biggest impacts in human history, like Yeshua ben Yosef, or as he is now known in the English-speaking world, Jesus, that if you look at what he taught and how he lived, it's all through the dictum of love thy neighbor as thyself, which is a wonderful way of saying that actually we're all one, which we would be if we all came from this original singularity. And that Nigel points out that the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, breaks everything apart in this physical universe. But maybe this momentum, this way of living that Jesus spoke about and followed, is a way that we can, the only way that we can reverse that to retain our past grandeur as humanity, as sentient beings. And perhaps if you do that enough, then if matter is frozen thought, you can unfreeze it, so to speak, by warming it up, if you like. And this is perhaps what the shroud image represents. Interestingly, if you look at what this particular individual taught, he was always at pains to point out that anything that he did, other people could do also, even better than he
right,
did.
Right.
And when he said, you know, isn't it written, you are gods, you know, that all this implies all of humanity has limitless potential. And I think this is just the shroud is to me, to summarize, is showing what limitless potential we have as human beings. And if we live in the way that this individual showed, that perhaps we can transform our very atoms, and that, you know, it's just, it's not a case of being goody-goody or you know, wanting to be praised or anything like that. It's just, or religion. It's got nothing to do with religion.
Right.
It's just got to do with sense and
right.
reason.
Right.
And no religion has any monopoly over it. It belongs to the world. It belongs to all of humanity.
Very well said, Dr. Andrew Silverman. It's a wondrous example, and I think a very fitting description. We've got to get away from these little clubs and look at the bigger picture somehow, or we're not going to make it. Stand by, back in just a couple of minutes. Okay, back, our final segment with Nigel Kerner and Dr. Andrew Silverman. Nigel, that was a wonderful presentation by Andrew. You're quite right. He's an extraordinary colleague. Please go ahead. We have just one segment left.
Yeah. I was just going to say, though, in looking at all this stuff about UFOs and so on, it was inevitably leading me to this conclusion, a conclusion, incidentally, I didn't want to actually face in the immediacy of its discovery, but I had to face it. It just kind of overwhelmed me that the connections were there. I believe, you know, now, without any doubt, that the resurrection of this character they call Jesus Christ was and is a real, tangible and scientifically verifiable event, Jeff. Can you imagine the consequences to Zionists, both political and fundamentalist religious, if you like, if it is discovered that the burial cloth that they call the Shroud of Turin turns out to provide scientifically bona fide evidence, scientifically, empirically bona fide evidence that
yes.
the individual it covered at death with mm-hmm. someone who controlled both states from within each other.
Wow.
In other words, that their Messiah came and they did not spot him for actually expecting him to be covered in gold braid or shining in golden rays or whatever. He came in as a lamb and went out like a lamb, a victim of their own narcissistic folly. Do you really think the Zionists could ever admit their folly in the light of the deaths of thousands of people establishing mm-hmm. their state of Israel and so on? Would they admit what would it would seem to be a compound?
Not a chance.
Like,
never happened. Never
against
happened.
Their interpretation of the Old Testament prophecies,
right.
which in fact were a collection of all kinds of derivations from everywhere, so to speak. At
right.
least they got it right by default. That's the ironical thing.
They got
it right by default.
Amazing.
But how do you tell them, and mm-hmm. these groups ascribing to the fundamentalist axiom, whether they be Muslim, Islamic, or whether they be Jewish, that they are a triumphant people, they are the Semitic people, if
mm-hmm.
they get together and work together in brotherhood as sons of Abraham, could be the most wonderful glory for the entire planet. Instead of which there seems to be dissension that is strewn amongst them all, tribalism and all these petty little small places they look at. And yet here in this cloth is a marvelous expression that actually says, you know, you have a power as human beingness, so to speak, to do this. Each of you, if you follow this marvelous axiomatic stance, of mind over matter, as Andrew was so beautifully put in what he said. You know, I believe that Christ, with his ultimate intelligence, his ultimate perception, would have had to leave something behind that would last into the future. He would have foreseen, you know, that over the centuries, the record of his words and deeds would be mangled and twisted by men for their own self-interest, that he might have left a biological legacy as the most powerful means of ensuring the continuance of his message for the redemption of humanity as a whole. This is for all of us, Jeff. It's not for tribes. It's not for petrol or oil. It's for all of us, saying something wondrous about each and every one of us, even the most wretched amongst us, have this capacity, you know. And, of course, the other dread sort of fundamentalists would be caught up with their knickerbockers down, so to speak. not least the most obsequious sort, if you like, we ascribe to in Christianity. There they are in their Pope mobiles and Cardinal Cadillacs.
We are absolutely, we are enmeshed, we are entwined, we are trapped in this pettiness of egomaniacal control over our fellow man, through whichever club you want to call it, it doesn't matter. How are we ever going to break these bonds, and will it have to be some DNA manipulation?
I'll tell you what, if there are men like you, with your gentle and wonderful way of presenting these things, I have to tell you, may you long continue forever, I'm sure you will, please, please be there in some kind of way to act as a kind of thought policeman, if you like, to give people the opportunity to sit and take stock quietly in their own silence, so to speak, in that special silence we all can go to sometime if the day's own troubles, you know, allow us to do that. And that's really what I'm trying to say. I came at this to look at a UFO phenomenon, nuts and bolts. Why does something go at 25,000 miles an hour and turn at right angle? How are these things appearing? How are astronauts accepting it? How are pilots saying they are here?
Right.
I believe this is a synthetic anomaly universe-wide, and we've got to see that science and technology doesn't impose SIM cards into our bloodstream so that we are controlled and the power of our own human aegis always dominates. The natural power of our natural human aegis always dominates anything artificial or synthetic. And if we allow this to creep in on us, we are truly lost. And that's the way I think that we can do the most lasting damage to our eternal scope, if you like.
I agree.
I'm sorry to sound like a preacher, but I have to say, you know, I'm gobsmacked by the wonderful way that you kind of allow us to kind of come and say to people, please, take a look. This is not to do with an individual ego. It's to do with the entire human family, so to speak. And I think if we can get rid of these terrorists and these small-minded individuals who are strewing the human race with such awful angst and so on, that maybe somewhere in some way we might still pull this thing off. And if these things are here, we might be able to cope with them and triumph over them finally.
Well, it's beautifully said. Andrew, we have just about 3 minutes left. Would you like to step in here and make a final comment or two for our listeners, please?
Sure. Well, as I say, about the Shroud, I always keep coming back in this interview to something that Nigel pointed out to me years ago, that this is something that any human being can do. Either look out at the sky or, you know, think about the sky and all the millions of stars that you can see there. In your mind's eye, you're containing all of that within your being. So in being conscious, in being aware, your size is limitless. And nothing physical can do that. Nothing inanimate can do that. The Earth can't do that. The galaxy can't do that. But that little dot on a little insignificant planet called a human being, that can do it, and that demonstrates the limitless capacity of human beings, which is what, to me, is what the Shroud is all about, that there's no limits to what humanity is capable of, but only if we unite instead of dividing, only if we care instead of killing.
Care instead of killing. I hope somehow, some way, that can come to pass. I honestly am not particularly optimistic in the in the macro sense of things. In the micro sense of things, I remain optimistic. When you get individuals away from groups and dogma and fear and angst and anxiety, they're able to function on a much higher level. It works. But getting them to separate is the trick. And I'm not sure how to do that.
I absolutely echo this, and it's something that I came through without being religious, in fact. I don't believe I'm religious at all in any kind of sense, but religion simply means the power of hope to achieve is what I'm trying to kind of get through, really, and that's what I learned in my researches and in writing the book, and all the stuff I put in there is an empirical way of getting into these fractions and expressions we call religion and religious thought and so on. But it really is to do with reason. It's to do with, look at it with your mind, analyze it. Don't believe anyone's take on anything till you've checked it out rationally. And I believe finally, you know, that this individual they call these Christs, if you like, I think they are principles in the universe. And he was these things are the antithesis of artificial synthetic life, like the greys and these robots we create on the way, so to speak. And I believe he's the provider, or these things are the provider of antidotes to their machinations with any natural living species like humanity. I believe the Christs are the pinnacle of naturalness, and that the greys and artificial things like that, that we create, and other plants do create too, are the complete opposite of that. So the battle is between naturalness and syntheticness. I believe it is in the defense, you know, Jeff, of this principle that is bestowed the power to access this eternal scope to exist and so on. And whilst I share, in a sense, you know, a thesis that you do, in the sense that it doesn't seem we will do it, but I'll tell you what, old chap, if you can appreciate the heart in a singer like, and I really do mean this, our wonderful tenor, you know, Mario Lanza, you can tell the difference between the technical expertise of a tenor and somebody who really is a tenor in the O-R sense, in the tenor, in the sense of what it actually means.
Indeed.
That's the important thing. You have the heart to see that difference. And that, if any human being has the same kind of tenor of mind, I do not believe they will ever be destroyed. No synthetic thing like a robotic gray could ever do that. And that's
said,
the great lesson to me about your program.
Well, thank you, my friend. You did get your package?
Yes.
Good.
I have to say that I don't want to speak about it on TV because it's too personal and private, and I'm too moved by it, by the way.
Oh, very good.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk again, Nigel. Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to another visit on the program soon. Dr. Andrew Silverman, thank you for being here as well and contributing so magnificently. What an amazing hour. Thank you, gentlemen, both very much, and my best to you. Okay, that's our program this evening, and that's another one to think about and listen to a couple, three times. All right, we'll be back Sunday night, and with you, of course, at Rents.com in the meantime, and then next week rolls around again. Take care. Have a good weekend. Enjoy.